I just want to make sure we're ready. That's all.
Okay. I'm always ready, motherfucker.
That's not true, and you know that that's
true. Let's do this.
Hello. We are the Brothers Geek. This is our podcast.
That's not an accent that exists in human
this,
world.
This is...
What was that?
I am not a human. I am a robot designed for podcasting. I am not programmed for...
That's actually a terrible robot voice.
I am Pterozoid, and that's not even close to it.
Seriously, right? That's... I mean, that's not even a good robot voice.
This is episode number 117 on August 17th. Of 2019.
I think it's safe to say that Patrick does not have a future as a voice actor.
Seriously. Is that an accent of the most boring human alive?
You are crushing my dreams.
I mean, that's nothing new. I've been doing
that
since
we've
been brothers.
We exist to crush your dreams.
My name is Patrick Schmaltz with my two brothers, Christopher and Andrew Schmaltz. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Patrick and Andrew. It's great to talk to you. And hello, everyone in podcast listener land.
Hello, podcaster listener land. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Hello. Happy Monday, everybody. It's a Monday.
Happy Monday. We're brothers. We're geeks. We talk about geeky things. Here we go. Soul Hot Patrick. Shouty.
Did you just read that out loud? The chat is supposed to be covert.
Good job. Covert. We are pros. How many? This is our second episode.
Well, do I need to turn this shit down or not? Fuck,
dude. Don't. You're shouting into the microphone, man.
Why are you shouting?
I don't know.
Don't need to shout.
I don't know either. You're excited. I understand.
I'm excited. Jesus,
shouting is okay. Jeez.
Well, don't squash my excitement. God.
Keep it. You know. 12 inch voices, dude. 12
inch voices. I don't even know what to do now.
You don't have to yell across the film set. It's okay.
True.
You don't have to be like, hey, fucker. I got that thing you wanted.
That's how I talk to all the actors.
You know, hey, you know what, Trey? Dude.
I got your Diet Coke right here.
Hey, dude. Hey, fucking bottle of water.
Dude, you know what trailer I saw before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the trailer for the Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
With Tom Hanks.
Won't you be my neighbor?
Fred Rogers. Won't you be my neighbor? It made me smile and feel warm and fuzzy and misty all over me.
100%, dude. 100%. I had the same trailer and I felt the same way.
It's just like no one can play that guy but Tom Hanks.
I watched that show constantly as a child.
Mm.
I don't have a lot of memories of the memories I have of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood are the little train that would like go into the other world, like the puppet world.
Yeah.
And,
things
and, you know, other things, and there was all that drama there. But the thing, and I don't know if it was Sesame Street or Mr. Rogers, but they would have these interludes of like short films of like you went to like there was like a 4-minute film on you went to like a saxophone factory, and it like showed you how a saxophone was made or something like that. I don't know if it was Mr. Rogers or Sesame Street, but
I think Rogers did that too.
Yeah, and there was no dialogue, but there was like as the saxophone would get made, there would be saxophone notes that would mirror like what was happening to the saxophone. It was being made. Like if the metal was being stretched or polished, like you would have like a higher saxophone note. Like it was like, you know, laughing, being teased or whatever. I just have vivid memories of that.
I'm going to Google like Mr. Rogers saxophone like making after this to find this video on YouTube. This exists. Yeah. Everything
could
exists
be,
on the internet.
Mr. Rogers, it could be Sesame Street.
Yeah, but that. Yeah, I mean,
okay.
You know,
okay.
But, my neighbors.
I have the most vivid memories I have is him standing next to the fish tank.
Oh, okay.
He
was always fussing with the fish tank.
Yeah, the fish tank.
Eating the fish. And
I never understood why he had like an outdoor sweater and then an indoor sweater. You're in your house now. You don't
is
need
that
a
something
sweater.
That existed? Like, I never I knew that he changed his shoes. Like, he had his like leather shoes for outside. And then he had his like house shoes.
And then he changed his sweaters. Yeah, he always had a red sweater inside. But it's like, you're in your house now. It's warm in your house. Like,
What? I don't know. It was part of his transition.
There's a documentary. I wonder if the documentary answers that question about why the hell he changed.
I've watched part of that documentary on HBO, I think.
The documentary. Yeah, it's on HBO.
He definitely... He might be that single human who has no skeletons in his closet. A famous person who achieved great things. But, you know, he never had the interlude of, 3 years he had, a coke habit that they hid behind the scenes. an illegitimate child.
He was a corporate climber or something.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, he's got an illegitimate child somewhere in the world.
He's just a genuine person.
Genuine person.
And he had this.
But who knows why the hell he put on a sweater and changed his shoes? I don't know.
Yes, it obviously made sense to him.
I mean, it was comforting. Maybe that's as simple as that. It was very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Calming.
So he's just singing a song, changing his shoes, and putting on a different sweater.
It just relaxed you.
The trailer makes the movie look great. And, I mean, Tom Hanks will get himself an Oscar nomination for sure.
Yeah,
That's
Have you guys heard about the fact that there's going to be a campaign to get Robert Downey Jr. a Best Actor nomination for Endgame?
What?
I hope he gets nominated.
There's chatter that I have seen, and I have kind of seen it in the Twitterverse of film Twitter about Disney, and they're because Oscar nominations and Golden Globe nominations, there's machinery in studios that, promote that kind of thing nominations. Yeah. Notoriously
throw tons of money at that.
They're going to promote and kind of because everybody, the people in the industry know who the members of the Academy are. They're going to actively campaign because all studios do this, but they're going to actively campaign to get Robert Downey Jr. a Best Actor nomination. I completely agree.
It's the culmination of 10 years of effort. Yep. It would be just like giving all the Oscars to the Return of the King, right?
Yeah, I agree.
It's not necessarily like his work in Endgame was incredible. It's the 10 years of movies and his character that he went through this whole time. His character's arc that he went through, that's what he deserves an Oscar for. Yeah.
Again, perspective. # Oscar's so dumb.
Yes. But
the fact is that this is how they do that shit, right? They reward him for, like you said, 10 years of work.
Yeah. I completely agree.
They should.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, think about how far we've come that as mainstream and kind of safe as the Oscars are. I mean, everyone was all 10 years ago, 11 years ago, The Dark Knight, which was not nominated for Best Picture.
Which is changing, admittedly, last couple of years.
Yeah, but there was the highest grossing film of that year and universally acclaimed in terms of its quality. And it was a comic book movie and it didn't get a nomination for Best.
It should have won all of them.
And it won. Heath Ledger won for The Joker, which admittedly that might be one of the best posthumously.
Yeah.
It might have been one of the best performances ever in film.
The great what if is that had he lived, would he have won?
That's the question that exists.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean
that's the unfortunate thing is they were calling attention to it. He did a really good job, but back then when those movies were coming out, people weren't taking comic books movies very seriously. The ones that are coming out were very uneven. X-Men and X2 were good, but they were only seen by comic book guys. They weren't making $1 billion each.
Yeah, but it had the Nolan blessing.
When a legit auteur filmmaker decides to take on.
Yeah.
And
that's what changed it. That's what changed it for sure, dude. So,
So anyway, that's chatter that I've heard. But some other chatter that we should
I'm
talk
all for
about,
that.
Topical. Mm. There is, and it'll be, I'm sure it'll be confirmed this week because D23, the Disney fan club convention that they have every year.
Yes, I've been seeing that.
Yeah, they announced some scheduling for things. If it's going to happen, they'll announce it this week. There's chatter out there that Ewan McGregor is going to return as Obi-Wan Kenobi for a Disney Plus series.
Mm.
I've seen that speculation.
Yeah. So
I don't know how I feel about that.
I love Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi, though.
Yeah. That's the thing is he was the best parts of the prequel.
I can't separate him from the shit movies, though, dude.
Oh, really?
The movies are shit.
He's my favorite part.
He did a good part.
But the favorite part of that, a speck of corn in a pile of shit, I'm not eating corn.
No. It's true. Okay. You're not wrong.
I can't disagree with that logic. I can't disagree with a stack of corn in a pile of shit either.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
But like flawless, but like, flawless logic.
If they could do it, it might be fun. And it's like, I mean, do they continue the story where he's just on Tatooine, like watching Luke grow up or whatever? Is this Gotham? Is this what this is? It's Gotham Tatooine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I imagine it is.
We know from the Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels, which are both part of Disney canon, the universe that exists in conjunction with the movies that have come out. Obi-Wan Kenobi had other adventures after Order 66. He had another encounter where he actually had a subsequent duel with Darth Maul on Tatooine, and he actually killed Darth Maul on Tatooine after Darth Maul finally found out where Obi-Wan Kenobi was.
Rewatch that movie, dude. The dude got cut in half. His intestines are gone. Like, it's not just his legs. Like, it is
part of the Disney
part of canon that he was grafted onto some legs, dude.
He exists in the Star Wars universe.
I found out a whole dude's dead. Come on.
Wow.
Not dead. Not dead.
I don't like that they keep trying to bring him back.
I have to say that I greeted that rumor with skepticism.
Okay.
So it didn't excite you, not necessarily enthusiasm.
Okay, no skepticism and not a lot of enthusiasm.
No.
Okay.
You know, I'll see what they do with it. Like, here's the reality. Disney's doing all this. He's got this like TV show stuff. They got this streaming service, and they own all this content. So they're making Star Wars TV shows. We're seeing The Mandalorian. We're seeing a bunch of superhero TV shows. We're seeing Scarlet Witch and Vision, or what it was, Wanda and Vision. We're seeing like all this other stuff, and so they
Falcon
have content.
And Soldier,
yeah, I would love to see like a live action Star Wars TV.
I'm excited for all of that.
Like, right, right, right.
I love the idea of all of that. I will
just tell the stories.
I'm an immediate subscriber to this. Right.
Yeah. It's just you don't necessarily like what story they would tell with Ewan McGregor is what
right. I've had a man crush on Ewan McGregor
for forever, so anything he does, I pretty much have a
yeah, I like him too.
I do too. And I would love to see him playing Obi-Wan Kenobi again.
I don't think Obi-Wan Kenobi
in his 50s, you know, he's
that's what I'm saying.
He's been a hermit, and then he gets caught up in some adventure. I don't know. I think my problem is, dude,
honestly, if I'm being honest with myself, mm-hmm. my problem is my view of Obi-Wan Kenobi is colored by the fact that he delivered the single worst line in the history of Star Wars movies. Ooh. Maybe all movies ever.
Yeah. What is the worst line?
Don't try it.
I have the high ground.
Anakin, I have the high ground. Standing on the high ground.
He's just like...
It's the worst effing line in all of Star Wars and maybe movie history.
Well, we were talking about most iconic lines on Twitter the other day, and maybe we should do a little the worst lines in movie history. Like
that's what happens at the top of my list will always be at the top of my list.
You know what's the top of mine?
Nothing
you know
will happens, ever top that.
Do you know what happens to a toad that's struck by lightning?
The same thing that happens to everything else.
The same thing that happens to everything else.
See, but that there's so logic terrible. In that line.
Yeah.
It's the worst. It's the worst writing. It is the epitome of those shit movies, the prequels.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And that third prequel should have been Dark Knight level awesome.
And it was good.
It almost is ruined for me by that line.
Yeah, I can't get there to that. I was totally ruined by that line, but it's really bad.
It was ruined, dude.
It's pretty bad.
Oh my god.
So I can't get past it, dude. I can't get past it. Obi-Wan is colored by that. I have to admit it.
Okay.
It's so eye-rolly. You're just like, oh.
It's so painful.
Yeah.
It's so painful.
Yeah. Some of the dialogue,
it's the opposite of everything I love about Star Wars.
Yep.
It's just
I don't have a good argument to make. I just don't. It's
there's no way to argue.
It's like gravity and that line are like two laws of the universe.
Here's the thing is like George Lucas isn't writing the dialogue of the TV show he's in. So he's not going to be saying shit like that. We hope that they get decent writers.
There's a smidge of hope because if he's not involved and he's not writing anything, then there's hope.
Yeah.
And we've seen, we are part of the vast majority of Star Wars fans that actually enjoy what Kathleen Kennedy and the creatives have done in the new universe and the new time.
Great films.
And, is there chatter about, underperformance, blah, 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 blah. But I think, the Last Jedi hate cult gets so much of the attention.
Fanboy dickheads.
Fuck off. The vast majority are excited for all new Star Wars content. And was there a point where the oversaturation may have been getting there with the fact that they were going to do all these anthology films and then they kind of rethought the process? I think that they made the right call there, but an Obi-Wan Kenobi series, that would secure my Disney Plus subscription.
Well, they have so much content, dude. I feel it. And they're coming under Netflix too. So hardcore. Like what are they saying? Like $8.99.
The combined subscription for $12.99 a month will add Hulu, ad-free Hulu.
Yeah.
ESPN. And add ESPN. Plus. Yep.
That's Disney like a no-brainer.
It's freaking automatic at that price point. Oh, no, dude.
They're launching it to, because Hulu and Amazon even, they don't rival Netflix in terms of.
No.
I mean, they have quality shows, of course, but in terms of like subscribers and total reach in pop culture, they don't get to the level of Netflix. This subscription service from Disney will absolutely get to that
content
level.
Alone. I mean, the content they bring to bear is incredible. So
exactly. I have to. You brought this up, Andrew, and I'd like to comment on it for a second. It's like Amazon lately has been hitting me pretty good, but The Boys is solid as hell.
It's a very good show.
I'm really excited about Carnival Row with.
I'm excited about Carnival Row as well. That looks cool.
I'm excited. I've been seeing pictures and hearing about like the Wheel of Time. They've been casting the Wheel of Time series. They're making this Lord of the Rings series
looks solid too. The cast looks awesome.
Awesome. So like Amazon's trying to show up, especially with
Amazon has The Expanse in December.
Yeah.
Have that like flagship best sci-fi show across all platforms starting, they're picking up season 4.
Yeah, totally.
Sure. So, that will get my subscription for sure just for that show.
Yep.
I mean, because I'm a devoted fan of that show.
I feel like Netflix has gotten to this point where they don't have anything that's like too, everything's kind of like middle of the road. There's nothing that's like too controversial or too hardcore or like
Sabrina season 1 was controversial and edgy. And I season 2 is not really held my attention.
Yeah.
I like the show, but season 1 of that show was amazing. Season 2 is kind of
I think your argument's slightly flawed, Patrick, in the sense that I see what you're saying in terms of there's nothing that's that surprising from Netflix anymore because we expect excellence from Netflix shows. So when Amazon comes at us with shows that are surprisingly good and Amazon, because in a lot of people's minds, Amazon is still just the website where you buy all your shit. But now they're producing really, really good entertainment.
People talk to me about Fleabag. I haven't watched it.
Fleabag.
Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Fleabag is an amazing show, brother. If you dig it, it has a penetration point that if you don't have affection or are not interested in the central character, you won't want to watch the show because it follows her narrative. Right. There's no real other narrative beyond her narrative. So don't buy into her and like her and are interested in her, you're not going to want to watch the show. But I loved it.
I heard some news about like this is callback to like some of our early episodes, but like they're casting the Penny Dreadful series. They're gonna do another series of Penny Dreadful.
Yeah, no, really? They announced that 6 months ago. They're gonna do another. Oh no,
I've been seeing announcements of like casting online and stuff.
It's gonna be set in 1930s Los Angeles.
Whoa.
And it's gonna be like anthologized. It's going to be set in 1930s Los Angeles, totally new cast. And
it's going to go right, and shit?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know if John Logan is writing it again.
What's it going to be on?
It's going to be on Showtime. And it's going to tie in directly to Southwestern and Mexican folklore.
Ooh.
Rather than the Victorian slant from London, obviously.
Love that.
It's going to have a Southwestern... Totally.
If it's the same creators, then I'm very excited. But we all love that show. That was like one of those weird, like darling, bizarre, like totally didn't
for us on so many levels.
Worked. It was so well made.
Payoff didn't quite work, but man,
season three was a little weak. But
season three payoff was a little rough. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. But that's a great show.
So much affection for that
show. Solid. I totally, dude. Oh man, I love that you have like more information about.
I love that. That
1930s Hollywood,
1930s like Los Angeles, and it's going.
There's a lot of possibilities there.
Oh yeah. Big time. I'm very excited for that. So I don't even know if it's in production yet, but they're getting very close to that.
Wow, you just proved your value in this podcast. Good job, Andrew.
Hey, sometimes I come through.
Sometimes he comes through. Christopher, you were talking about watching Another Life. How far are you into that?
Oh, I am, I'm a completionist, right? And so I have to finish.
Yep.
And I'm on episode 9.
For our people who don't know, Another Life. Sci-fi show with Katie Sackhoff.
She plays like
an astronaut. Netflix original.
Sci-fi horror slash angsty piece of anyway.
You're describing why I stopped watching. I got to episode 3 and then I gave up.
It's a slog, dude. It's painful and it's really that and incoherent.
I wanted to give it a shot because Katie Sackhoff from Battlestar fame.
I have painfully made it through. I'm in the middle of episode 9 and dude, it is an unpleasant watch.
Oh yeah, you're hate watching at this point.
And I have to finish.
Oh man,
I feel I'm compelled to finish. I'm a fan of Katie Sackhoff, but she is so unlikable. Like no, that's part of the problem, right? Is she is compelling as an actor.
Yeah,
but holy shit, none of the actors are likable. I don't like any of them.
Wow.
And the storylines are either retreads of other sci-fi tropes or incoherent dumb shit or what the hell is happening right now? And this doesn't make any sense. And why are these people fighting all the time? And what is the point of what they're saying or what they're doing? There's a whole lot of that through 9 episodes.
How did you make it through 9 episodes?
Dude,
that sounds like self-flagellation, buddy.
I'm in a period right now where I'm abusing myself. So
it sounds like you're just desperate for something like to watch.
I just need to feel something.
Jeez.
Good.
Even if it's painful. Even if it's pain.
Oh my god.
Is this a cry for help, Pat? Christopher, are we a cry for help podcast right now?
Right on the podcast. No, cry for help.
I'm all sure. good, but like I said, I'm a completionist, and I'm a huge sci-fi fan, and I'm a fan of Katie Sackhoff. So I will finish episode first season, but I will not watch a single episode after this.
Yeah,
after it's complete, it is not good.
I want it to be good. I want it to be good because I like Katie Sackhoff, and I actually like that actor Tyler. I'm going to butcher his name. Hoechlin.
Hoechlin, I think is
Hoechlin.
He plays Superman on Supergirl for the CW. He plays
I love that actor, and he's in. he's in a lot of this. This, mm-hmm. I mean, spoiler alert: he gets killed in the first episode, but he's in the mm-hmm. the episodes, the other mm-hmm. episodes, and no, exactly what you're saying, Christopher. It's just so much like navel gazing, like drama for drama's sake, instead of like actual things that are happening to these people, and they have to figure stuff out, and we're like learning about them.
Yeah.
You don't give a shit about anybody.
No,
I don't give two shits about any character.
Exactly. Like, and that's the main problem with the entire show is that I am not rooting for any of them. That's except for the kid.
Oh yeah. The kid.
The kid who's on Earth.
Yeah. The kid who's on Earth is not dealing with any of this. Like has a mom that left him and a dad that is obsessed with
this. The cliche of all cliches. She becomes intimately involved in episode 8, dude. So,
of course,
it's even more hacky than you think, because the only character you care about is the kid, and she's uninvolved at all until episode 8 when she becomes directly involved. And of course she does, because it's a lazy piece of shit.
So. That sounds lazy.
Jeez. Okay. Good. I'm glad I didn't continue.
And they don't involve her in a creative way. They involve her in the worst way possible.
Oh man.
Oh god.
Honestly. It is not even creative. It is just painfully dumb.
It's okay.
Yeah.
But you're gonna finish it.
I am gonna finish it. I have an episode and a half left.
Amazon got your eyes on it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
All right. Well, I mean, should we
let us know how it wraps up, because I am a firm believer.
I will report.
If you have a solid end to your story, it can make up for flaws.
It's got to be real good, because like, man, if it continue, everything Chris is saying is the continuation of what I felt in episode 3.
Yep. It does not recover.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna be the greatest episode of in TV history.
Oh wow!
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, Andrew.
I recently binged Mindhunter season 2, and anyone can listen and know that we loved Mindhunter season 1, and David Fincher is part of our pantheon of filmmakers that we
I haven't watched any of. I haven't watched any of Mindhunter. Like,
you haven't.
No,
you didn't watch any of season 1?
Not a lick. Tell me why I should.
Well, just give you the 3-second elevator pitch about what the series is about. It's set in the late 70s, and it's a fictionalized version of the founding of the Behavioral Sciences Unit at the FBI and the agents who like went and interviewed serial killers to start to develop psychological profiles that all cops basically use now surrounding serial killer investigations. They like started the science.
Okay.
So the first season,
small unit of 2, then it became 3.
And now through season 2, it's become a much more large part of what the Bureau does.
Mm.
And I love season 1. It's got Fincher's whole aesthetic, and it deals with, serial killers and kind of the science that evolves out of that, and how the people, the characters who are associating themselves and interviewing serial killers, the cops who are actually trying to develop the science and do all that, how they're affected by interacting with these people who are abnormal.
Well, and the Fincher aesthetic and the Fincher genius is that all of these characters who are trying to solve all these crimes and develop a database of profile, they're all complex, flawed human beings as well.
Yep.
And so the genius is in the details associated with their complexity interacting with these people who killed multiple people and are in jail for it. It's a fascinating show.
It's a fascinating show. And season 2 picks up right where season 1 ends. And it expands on some things that are started in season 1, but it picks up a live case where not actually, like, it's not a thing where we like go back. They have instances where they go and they interview people, actual historical figures that, you know, they have interviews that they sought. They actually interview Charles Manson in one of the episodes of this season, because it's set right around that time where he'd been in jail for like a few years after all the Manson family murders, which will lead directly into what we're going to talk about in a minute. But it's season 2 actually tracks an active investigation for a serial killer that I'd never heard of. A serial killer investigation in Atlanta, Georgia, in the late 70s, early 80s, where lots of African-American young boys were abducted and killed.
Wow.
Like over 20.
No kidding?
That they could. And I won't explain all of it, but it tracks that investigation, and the new unit gets directly involved in that.
Wow.
And it is it's a multiple episode story arc that they tell about this real life murder investigations that I'd never heard of. Like, you hear, you know, some of the serial killers, you can't help but know their names just because they've been kind of, you know,
they've been so infamous.
Yeah. There's so much in popular culture, but I never heard of this particular investigation. Huh. They get involved in that case, and it's an interesting, great story. And the themes that were started in season one are definitely built on in season two.
I'm definitely watching it because I love season one.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a different pacing, and being involved in an active investigation for multiple episodes in season two, it feels more procedural than the first season did.
What about Anna Torv?
She's all time, you know, she's great, dude. Her story is great.
She's in genre pantheon, dude.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, being Fringe, and she crushed it. Yeah, she's great as the doctor.
Fringe got real weird, but, you know, honestly, I still liked it.
The first couple seasons of Fringe are as good as sci-fi procedural.
I need to rewatch that.
Fringe is pretty good. Fringe answered all its questions
And we associate Fringe. Yeah. Fringe has a special place with us because that was the year Fringe got really popular around the time when we were going to Comic-Con every year. And they promoted Fringe every year.
We watched the pilot.
Four months before it aired.
Yes, we did.
They showed like an hour and a half of the pilot at Comic-Con, and we watched it.
And we were like, you know, I'd watch this for sure.
Exactly.
Dude, it's been too long since I've been to a convention.
I nominate Anna Torv for the Not Ugly Award for this
episode. Yeah.
Second.
Absolutely. She's fantantic.
She's great.
Should we talk about Once Upon a Time?
And she's a great actor. She's awesome.
Is a great actor. Yeah, let's talk. All three of us have seen it. Let's talk about it. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
We are going to do a spoiler review of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. If you care at all, you should maybe skip ahead for a little bit. And
we'll put the timing in the show notes.
You have been warned.
We'll put the timing in the show notes.
We'll do our best to put the timing in the show notes. It's just show notes. So
Christopher saw it most recently. Christopher, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. What do you think of this movie?
I need to see it again. It's a long ass movie.
It's close to 3 hours, right?
It is 2 hours and 40 plus minutes.
Yep. Yeah. But honestly, you didn't feel it, right? I mean,
no, it's really the most sort of stately paced Tarantino movie, I think he's made, where most of his movies there's a frenetic sort of forward movement, right? This is a fairy tale, in the end of an era in Hollywood, and it is a period piece of love by Tarantino, clearly, and I found it amazing. I found it compelling. I found the characters to be interesting. I found his depiction of Hollywood and his treatment of the era of that late 60s Hollywood to be fascinating. And I found his take on the old world of Hollywood versus hippies, changing of the guard, changing in the culture, and his commentary on all of that to be really, I enjoyed it a lot. It was it's a weird sort of, and then, you know, the ending produces some visceral sort of things that he can't help himself.
Yeah.
Put into a film, and he is unbelievably good at making sure that you feel all of the violence, right?
Right.
He out of any director makes it so visceral to experience the violence that you're watching. Mm-hmm. It's painful at times to watch because it's
when he slamming that girl's head into the table. Jesus. Like I was like, geez, like I had no,
he doesn't pull any punches.
It's glorified. It's like ridiculous, obviously, but it's so like, he just doesn't stop. Like he, like you'd expect him to stop after a couple, but no, he keeps doing it. And you're just like, whoa, this is very hardcore.
It is hard. And I think, obviously, I think that's intentional. I think it's not to make it cartoony. I think all of his depiction of violence in all of his movies is to emphasize the fact that it draws you in and repulses you all at the same time, right?
Well, and I think that...
Rather that than being cartoony. Cartoony violence is superhero stuff.
Well, I mean, the most cartoony film he's ever done is Kill Bill, and it's meant to be cartoony. I think the violence that he does do,
yeah, that whole thing is an homage to a style,
specific type of film. Yeah,
right.
He doesn't shy away from the violence because violence is repulsive. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to make you feel uncomfortable to witness.
And it's in contrast to all the other quiet moments that he's such an expert at.
Exactly.
And they're, this whole movie, in my estimation, is lots of quiet moments,
mm-hmm.
sort of talking about the exchange with the exchange on the movie set, the pilot of the Western, where what's his name?
Rick Dalton.
And DiCaprio's character, yeah.
DiCaprio's character has with the little girl.
Yeah.
The writing is so great, and the acting in that scene is so amazing.
That's my favorite scene in the movie.
He's such a genius in pulling that out and depicting sort of that, oh my God, these two people are working actors at different levels, and she is so like invested in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny and poignant and touching and hilarious. I just
kind of tragic.
I loved every
very, very tragic. Oh my God.
It's sad. You all those things are going on at the same time,
right?
And they're all working on you at the same in the same way.
You know, I've actually
incredible filmmaking.
I've actually, you know, been around actors the last few years, like a bunch, and I have to say that they are very influenced by their careers and like what people think of them, and it's some of them are like genuine people, and some are a little weird, you know. And it's like there's a lot going on there, and they to get to where they need to go. There's something that's like different about them. They're like tortured souls a little bit. And some of them can handle the torture, and some of them are like, you know, John Candy, where they do a bunch of drugs and they die. You know, it's like it's to get to that level, to be that kind of a person, I think there has to be something that is going on that is different. You're a little off.
Yeah.
You know, I love that you can see that in his character so much, because that's like real to me. Like I've seen that. It's like very, very real. And
have you also seen the scenes where the guy is just faltering and doesn't know his lines?
Oh my God!
Calls out line.
So I won't say the name of the actor.
Painful. It's just painful.
I've been in a room with a guy who was an actor who his peak had gone away, and he is, you know, he's an actor you would know the name, absolutely. Yeah. And he's got this big monologue, this big speech, and he keeps fucking it up.
Wow.
And he can't do it. They even go to the PAs, write him cue cards off screen.
Oh wow.
So that they can keep it. And he doesn't want to read the cue cards, and he starts arguing with the director on set. And you're like, there, like the crew members are standing around and you're like looking and it's just like, dude,
painful.
What are you doing? So yeah, I've seen, I like that's pretty tame to what that's the extreme one that I've seen is like guy can't, but like people forget their lines all the time. People like little stuff, but it, for the most part, actors are very professional and they're very like on top of it. But what you start to see is I've seen a lot of actors who are very self-destructive. They party hard. This industry, you work a long hours and then you have a lot of time off.
A lot of downtime. Yeah.
A lot of downtime. So your ups and downs, you're like, go, go, go. And then take a minute and slow. So we work all hours of the day, all hours of the night. Well, so it breeds a party culture. It breeds a drinking culture.
This movie captured a lot of that, right? Compelling and real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very, very real. And this movie's a love letter to Hollywood and
it's
LA
amazing how we're talking about this film because, I mean, Chris started it. He started talking about this as how it's a fairy tale and it's, you know, how Quentin Tarantino's kind of love letter and homage to this. But
Quentin Tarantino is such a good writer, though.
That's what I'm saying. Let me make my point. Doesn't feel trivial. What these people are going through. And even kind of the, you know, there's a little bit of distance that exists in the movie because there's a narrator who will kind of, give us context for things that are going on. And we know that there is certain events that this building, that the movie is building
to.
We should talk about that.
Don't forget about that. Because
yeah, we should talk. But
we need to talk about that narration.
Yeah. We talk about, you know, the fairy tale aspects, kind of the surreal aspects of it. But at the same time, you feel the shit that Rick Dalton is going through, the, you know, his stuntman Cliff and what he's, you know, gets involved in and swept up in and how he kind of is dealing with his life and, you know, the circumstances of what it's like to kind of be on the fringes and dependent on this person and his fading star and how he's going to like deal with that aspect of his life. It you get intimately involved with these two guys. And then of course, Sharon Tate, who I like how she's depicted in the movie. And I like Margot Robbie's performance, of course. She abused her with so much charm and so much kind of energy. I wish that we had more about her kind of internal life.
Yeah.
Tarantino does it. I can see why Tarantino did it a certain way because she has been mythologized in such a way that, I mean, she was killed by these people, by these members of the Manson family in our history. And how she's become part of Hollywood lore. And now she's, you know, she only did a couple of movies but she was right on the cusp of being like this humongous movie star.
Superstar.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what I think is like, okay, I will say this. It's like, I saw the interview. I don't know if you remember seeing this, but like Quentin Tarantino, like a reporter says to Quentin Tarantino, like she doesn't have very much dialogue. Like in the film,
I saw that exchange. Yeah.
And he says, I reject your hypothesis is his answer. And I thought about that and I was like, yeah, like he wanted something different from.
Well, because this is part of the controversy we should talk about. The question what's underlying that question is that he treats women poorly or that he gives women short shrift in his movie. Which is shit.
That's the underlying
the premise of the stupid question.
That's exactly right. He's rejecting that is part of his filmmaking. But I will say this. When I saw the movie, she doesn't say a word for a good 30 minutes. But he could be doing that because she was a real life person and he doesn't want to write what she was thinking or saying or doing because she was a person that got killed. Like,
well, it's also a narrative choice, and you understand this, Patrick, as well as it's a narrative choice when you don't give someone that's on screen dialogue. Directors will talk about how, and screenwriters will talk about, because it's a visual medium as much as it's auditory. That's what people who really talk about and dissect film, it's film marries together the visual, the auditory, the writing aspects of it,
music. And this movie is visual as they fucking get. Like,
oh, 100%. And here's the main point that I took away. This movie is not about Sharon Tate.
No.
Yeah.
Not.
No.
And so you get just enough of her to understand what that whole scene, the whole scene where she goes into the theater and watches herself in that great movie and revels in the experience the people who are in the theater having,
right?
Laughing at her delivery, the wonderful experience that the audience is having, and her experience of that tells you everything you need to know about Sharon Tate and her role in that transition time in Hollywood and why it was so hugely important about what happened to her.
He
does that. The genius in that scene.
That's genius.
Is the communication of her joy in the joy that she brought to others in that experience and how much she enjoyed that. She is genuine. She's an artist.
Mm-hmm. You are utterly charmed by her. Charmed by her in that scene.
Charmed by her just genuine love of the fact that people around her are enjoying
her film.
Yep. Right?
Yep.
That's all you need to know. It doesn't need to be. You don't need more depth from her to feel the dread of the approaching killers. Right? You don't need anything more than that. Other than knowing she's pregnant and she's a genuine artist.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is Tarantino's point.
I agree.
In my mind.
No, and I can't disagree with that.
Yeah.
I can't disagree with that. I think that it's I say underserved and I say that I want more because Margot Robbie makes her so compelling and she's interesting so to watch the movie.
Yep.
And Tarantino creates these scenes where she's charming and interesting and you are involved in her story so much that you want to see her more. And I think that's the point because we don't get to see that. Sharon Tate is dead. She didn't get to have a long career where we got to experience her screen.
Right. Yeah. So we all know that.
That's the genius of the movie in my mind. One of the many levels of genius is we all know that we never get to see her again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can watch the minimal movies she made, right? The few movies she made, and never again. Mm-hmm. And that underlies the dread of the last half of that movie, right?
For sure. What do you guys think of the scene with Bruce Lee and Cliff Booth? Because there's people on the internet that are a little bothered by...
I
want to
hear your take on it, because I have a definite take on this.
Well, okay. The people on the internet is like, it's disrespectful. Like this white guy can beat up Bruce Lee. And he's like talking shit on set. And he's like kind of this pompous guy and they're portraying him that way. But like from interviews and stuff that I've seen of Bruce Lee, that's kind of how he was. Like he was kind of like, he liked to show off. He liked to be bravado. And I think what Quentin Tarantino is just trying to say is like, you're an actor. Like you're like a real stunt guy could probably beat your ass. Like, and I think that they were just trying to show that Cliff Booth was such a badass that he could beat up Bruce Lee. Like that's what he's trying to say.
I think that, and Bruce Lee has become such a mythologized.
Oh yeah.
Image in our culture.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. I mean, I love, I think it's been a long time since I've sat and watched a Bruce Lee movie all the way through, but the Bruce Lee fans are huge Bruce Lee fans.
He was involved
in all these different, he appeared on screen. He has this interesting life story of coming from Hong Kong and then, you know, getting involved in Hong Kong cinema and then being his early death.
Like he's like a legend, you know,
people don't want to see him made light of. It's almost like it's almost like he's sacrosanct. Like, you can't make fun of somebody that people love that much.
Right, right,
and identify so much as just being such a badass.
And that's a time in the internet right now where everybody is so sensitive.
Everything is precious.
Everything is precious and everything is sensitive. And don't talk shit about the thing that I love. Well, you know,
the people, here's my take on this. The people who are saying all this miss the whole fucking point of that entire scene. Because that entire scene is a fucking daydream.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
By Cliff Booth, who's kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who is a old school, kind of probably racist dick.
Probably.
This is the point.
Yeah.
He is up on the roof fixing the fucking antenna. And then he has a daydream about getting the job on that movie set that he his friend pressures the guy who doesn't want to give him the job. That entire scene is a Cliff Booth stuntman daydream because it ends with him saying, back in the real world on the roof, yeah, that's about it. He would have gotten fired from the movie.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That is the whole point of that scene. It has nothing to say about the ability or lack of ability or arrogance of Bruce Lee or anything. It is through the prism of Cliff Booth's mind.
Yep.
Well, That's it.
And what's also interesting is like this scene with like you see that Cliff Booth might have killed his wife, but we never come back to it. This is the hero of the movie. might have murdered his wife on the boat. And then there's like room and he's still working in the industry but he's got
a good picture of the dude.
No, he's like, he's not like this, like true blue good guy.
I will say this though. He is kind of the old school Hollywood tough guy.
Totally.
And, but in terms of like, a person with a moral center, I think he's the most kind of like moral and honorable person in the whole movie. He's loyal to his friend. He definitely has a code. He's loyal to, you know, he understands that some shady shit is going on with the Manson family out in this ranch. He's concerned that his friend's being taken advantage of. So he has a code.
He doesn't accept a blowjob from a clearly underage girl.
Exactly.
I kind of love the idea that you never really like know if he killed his wife because like that's like the rumor. It's like the rumor on the street is he killed his wife, and all of Hollywood is like your reputation. All these movies are like what your reputation is, and people start to like whispers about like, dude, he went out on his boat. He came back with his wife. His wife was dead. But like you see the scene and he's obviously drunk and it could have been an accident. But like that's what, and he didn't go to prison for it. So well, it's
ambiguity
like,
is exactly what he's
the
going
ambiguity for. Is exactly what it's going for. And it's like,
and
it's
you
like,
kind he, of, you yes. get to the point where his wife seems kind of terrible.
Oh,
so you're kind of like,
you were like,
well, he doesn't deserve to die.
I mean, you kind of are like,
so that complexity mixes in with it because it's okay.
Yes.
Kind of a bitch.
She's kind of terrible.
But does she deserve to die? Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah. That's the wink and the nod that Tarantino does, man. I mean, we talked about this last week to kind of bring our discussion kind of full circle. I mean, then we got to talk about the end though as well. The historical fact is that members of the Manson family killed Sharon Tate and her friends on the night that is the end of this movie.
Yes.
But the movie depicts a scenario where they actually end up in Rick Dalton's house and they
instead of going up the hill to Sharon Tate or Polanski Tate house, killing everyone there.
Yeah.
They decide to go into Rick Dalton's house.
They go into Rick Dalton's house because he's a complete and utter dick to them.
Yeah, exactly. His drunken ass yells at them because they pull their loud car up.
He's high and drunk, and then he yells at them holding a picture of margaritas. Just because their car is loud and shitty looking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have you guys noticed the entire picture with him and drinks out of it? That's so funny. In the cul-de-sac.
Have you seen, though, Quentin Tarantino has had in multiple films The blended margarita has appeared in multiple films that he has made.
Oh, that's a great point. We can't even talk. We haven't even talked about like Tarantino versions. There's so many women's feet in this fucking movie. There's so many women's feet all over this goddamn movie. And Tarantino just shoots feet so much. Oh my God. There's got to be like a super cut of all the Quentin Tarantino women's feet.
The margarita scene in fucking Kill Bill is one of my favorite scenes of that entire those two movies.
Oh yeah. I love that too.
I'm gonna have to go back and look because there's got to be blended margaritas that appear in like Pulp Fiction. There's got to be blended margaritas that appeared in other movies because
I'm trying to think. If it's got to be in like Jackie Brown or something, or like Death Proof, I feel like there's a moment in Death Proof where somebody orders like a blended margarita.
So there's got to be.
I think they're at the bar.
They're at that bar and they order like there's got to be a blended margarita in that scene. Oh my god.
Yeah, it's like his. It's a drink that he puts in his.
Again,
it's a drink that he likes. It looks.
It's so great.
Oh my god, it's so good.
But yeah, so they get into Rick Dalton's house after Rick Dalton is drunk and high and his mouth's off to them. They go back up. They're gonna kill and rob Rick Dalton, and his stuntman Cliff Booth, who does all the dangerous shit and helps carry the load. That's his job and his role. You know, his attack dog that you fall in love with throughout the entire movie because this extraordinarily loyal dog that Cliff loves, end up, you know, saving the day. And the, you know, you have these three
killing
or four
the home invaders, killing the home invaders, family members
in complete, gruesome. You know, Quentin Tarantino, hyper visceral, gruesome violence.
When I saw the flamethrower in the garage at the beginning of the movie,
right?
I immediately was like, flamethrower, end of the movie, flamethrower. Like, yeah. It's gotta happen. That thing's coming out of that freaking closet.
So Cliff Booth, Rick Dalton saved the day, kill the Manson family members. Sharon Tate survives. Mm. Her friends survive in the movie.
And then invite Rick Dalton up.
Exactly, which is so kind of the
that's Rick why Dalton, it you know, is a the fairy two, tale.
Exactly, the two, the just juxtaposition of the two stars and their decline and ascendance,
right?
And how really they're just neighbors.
Yeah,
and Sharon Tate ends up being this sweet person who wants to get to know her neighbor and is a little bit of a fan of her neighbor. Seen him on TV before.
Oh my gosh. No, relationships like that, like you just go to like one party and suddenly you met
and he's
the
in a Polanski movie. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yep.
Yeah. Right. Is that the unknown there is that Rick Dalton then gets cast in a Polanski movie and he has a whole second career.
Yep.
Like, I will say this, though, it's like I kind of shit on this the last episode, but this movie has like very little plot to it, but it's so beautiful.
Very little plot.
And like the actors, all the actors are so effing good. Like,
I just want to be in Hollywood in the late 60s. It makes
honestly,
me want to
be
there.
I don't think that there's, I don't think DiCaprio or maybe even Brad Pitt have done better work recently.
I mean,
they are so good in this movie.
Well, I think, did I message you guys? I messaged you guys because my immediate reaction after this movie is, holy shit, Brad Pitt is a fucking movie star. This dude is incredible.
Good. Yep.
He is incredible in this movie. And he just epitomizes star.
Yep.
Dude, when he's driving around LA after he drops him off and he's like hauling ass down
is
all
incredible.
He's so good. Yeah. He's so good.
People it was said actually and it makes sense for Brad Pitt too, but it was actually said about the guy who did Inside the Actor's Studio. He made this comment about Michelle Pfeiffer that has always stuck with me because she is so beautiful and so attractive. Her talent can sometimes get overlooked because of how attractive she is.
You're just enthralled
because of how attractive she is, how amazingly good looking she is. Yeah. Brad Pitt is kind of the other side of that coin. You can miss his talent because he is so good looking.
If he's
the co-winner of the not ugly.
We're only allowed to give out one episode.
No, you can do. We've done co.
We've done male and female.
Yeah, all right, so male. I'll take a male and female. That's fine. I'm fine.
He's co-winner.
Yeah. Brad Pitt has aged into himself so well.
Yeah. He still looks great.
He's 55 years old, man.
Crazy
how, you know, and he looks in his 50s, but he is a great looking 50.
Fit. Dude, he's still fit. He's still fit.
Still looks great. Yeah.
Well, what I want to. I mean,
we got to talk about
reaction to the narrator in the last like 20 minutes.
It kind of took me out of it a little bit.
I hated that. I hated
the jump ahead stuff.
No, the whole narration leading up to the home invasion and the killing and all of that.
I hated that narration. It was kind of like this forensic files, like this is the police report.
What do you think
later
artistically he was trying to do with that? I don't understand that.
Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe he just was hoping, trying to give, because it's been such a well documented timeline,
right?
Like Hollywood lore, that he wanted to like reference that specifically. The fact that, you know, Sharon Tate's last moments are so well documented that he wanted to do like his version of it.
Yeah, like that, like this is where they were like,
yeah, but
you're
why would you do that with voiceover? I don't understand. Is it like an homage to the like a true like fairy tale, like Princess Bride kind of overarching narration?
Well, there's narration earlier in the movie, like
it's at that key moment. Artistically, I don't understand the purpose of that.
I think
it's just a conscious choice.
It is a totally conscious choice. And I don't necessarily think that it adds as much as maybe Tarantino hoped it would. And he might have had a specific vision in mind for
what he wanted. I'm trying to.
It's such a kind of Hollywood lore event that he wanted to do his own version.
Yeah,
of the timeline.
I think you're right. That's exactly right, Andrew. He's doing like the police report. Some guy is reading the police report of what happened, of the events of Quentin Tarantino's timeline. He's telling you they went to here.
It's building to, you know, in the back of your mind that the storylines are going to intersect somewhere.
Yes.
And
yes,
it helps establish that idea that these two storylines are going to intersect at some point.
And this is where the characters are leading up to it. It creates tension because it sounds like a police report. And so you're like, oh shit, somebody's getting murdered tonight.
I didn't get any of that.
You didn't get it?
I knew what was going to happen.
I knew Sharon Tate got murdered, but I didn't know like the date. And I thought I knew that it was that the Manson family did it, but I didn't know like all the detail that was included.
I didn't know all the details either. I knew Sharon Tate. I didn't know her, like all her friends. I didn't know who these other people were all there. I didn't know she was pregnant.
Yeah.
I just vaguely knew that
Sharon Tate was murdered, and I thought it was by members of the Manson family. But beyond that, I really all the details and the timelines of it and how all. And I think that I'd heard that she was with Roman Polanski, because I read the novel. So Roman Polanski did the version Tess of the D'Urbervilles. She goes and buys a version of a book to give to him as a gift. She appeared in that movie. She plays Tess. I read that book my freshman year of college, and then we watched part of the Roman Polanski movie as part of a literature class. So that was my first kind of exposure to her. And I knew that her and Polanski were involved, but I gleaned the fact that she was murdered and all that from other things. Like,
this
I
is
never
a good point. This is a good point for me to plug another podcast. Right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The name of this other podcast is called You Must Remember This.
Oh yeah, I've listened to this.
It is this podcast, done by a person named Karina Longworth.
Yep, I listened to this one. It's good.
Yeah, she does a. Looks like it's a 10-part series on this entire episode.
Holy shit!
It is all about the Hollywood of the late '60s. Leading up to the Manson murders, And then a deep dive into Manson's family, the context in which all of this happens, why it's such an important event in pre and post sort of the old Hollywood versus new Hollywood. Let's see how many parts there are. There are 10, 11, 12 parts to this Charles Manson's Hollywood in this podcast. Again, the podcast is called You Must Remember This.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
12 part series on Charles Manson's Hollywood. Really good so far. Okay. And it gives context for all of this.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to listen to that. That sounds...
You should. I'm listening to it right now. It's great.
There's this whole subgenre of murder podcasts that exist. There's true crime podcasts.
And but you must remember this podcast is about Hollywood and secrets and untold tales.
No, I'm down for that. I'm glad that it... But true crime podcasts are like a huge thing. And this sounds like an interesting kind of... I don't want to just listen to true crime podcasts. I want to listen to something like this. So this sounds great.
I highly recommend it. Anyway.
Okay.
I just had a real problem with that narration at the end. I'm trying to understand what the artistic reason why you would put that in. I don't get it.
Well, this just came to me. It might have been just another device to remind you that you're watching his version. It's like, this isn't history. This is a movie version of what
this isn't what actually happened. This is the fictionalized version. I was bothered by it. Like I like all of your qualms. Like I hear what you're saying and I get it. But unbothered.
I have a problem with narration.
It broke the tension for me.
I have a problem with narration that doesn't. I like narration in a lot of ways if it's done correctly, obviously. But
we talked about this last episode in the Blade Runner stuff. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But the narration only appears really kind of at one or two parts in the movie, and it doesn't appear. You don't hear the narrator for almost 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
So it can be jarring when all of a sudden a narrator comes back in.
Yeah,
What the hell? This narrator hasn't said anything for 2 hours and now he's giving me a play by play.
Why are you talking now?
Yeah, no, I understand that it can be. I was taken out of it a little bit. It was jarring for me.
Man, you guys are just making me want to watch this movie.
100%.
Yeah, no, I need to go to it again.
I want to go see it again.
Oh, man. It's so good. It's so good. It's
really good.
That we've all seen it, Pat, Chris, where would you place it? And I know it's fresh in your mind. Is it towards the top of your Tarantino list or towards the bottom?
It's top half.
Yeah, I could
definitely
see that.
Definitely top half for me too. Like Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, maybe Once Upon a Time. Like,
yeah, I could see that.
Like, I definitely watched this over watching Reservoir Dogs ever again. I saw Reservoir Dogs twice.
I would watch this over Reservoir Dogs. I would watch this over Hateful Eight.
I watch this over Hateful Eight.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, Hateful Eight didn't. I would definitely this over Django also. I like Django.
Oh, definitely over Django. Like, this one's fun. This one has fun. Brown. This one's the most fun Quentin Tarantino movie.
Oh, I think, it's easily the funniest Quentin Tarantino. And it's really funny. He writes funny movies. I mean, darkly funny. But this is a funny movie.
I feel like Death Proof is pretty funny. It's dark and gritty and disgusting, but it's pretty fucking funny. Like,
I've never seen that all the way through.
Death Proof is a good one.
Death Proof is good.
And also, I'm gonna defend Quentin Tarantino for a second. And yes, there are instances where he has problematic relationships with his actresses. That's that with his actors, his female actors. I shouldn't say actresses. With his female actors, that's documented. But when people think that his films give short shrift to his female characters, I'll highlight Uma
That's
Thurman
lazy.
And Pulp.
It's lazy. It's not accurate.
It's not accurate. Uma Thurman is, I mean, yes, everybody remembers how compelling John Travolta is and how great the relationship he has with Samuel L. Jackson is in Pulp Fiction. Uma Thurman is easily the most watchable part of Pulp Fiction.
Yep.
She is that, so fun.
That scene where they go to the diner is amazing. It's amazing.
Okay. Also, I mean, what Uma Thurman did in the Kill Bill films is incredible. She gets overlooked in terms of her performance all the time and how great a character she is in those movies. And people forget about Death Proof. Death Proof is a female-driven movie. The main characters are all female, and they all take down the killer together. They're the toughest and smartest characters in that movie.
Right, right.
So, of the 9 movies he's made, I would argue that half of them have great, interesting characters who are female.
Inglourious Basterds, the centerpiece of that whole movie are the women.
Exactly. Yeah.
The woman takes down takes down Hitler and most of the higher up of the Nazi party.
She's the hero. She is the hero. Right. Yeah.
Yes. So
fuck off people who think that Quentin Tarantino doesn't write women well. Sorry.
I will say this since it's in my brain, I gotta get it out. Zoe Bell's acting is not good. She might be a great That scene with her,
stunt woman, she's not a good actor.
Yeah, like well, that scene where she's like yelling at them. Like I was like,
Zoe Bell plays the wife who hates Cliff Booth.
Yeah, the wife who hates Cliff Booth, who's on set, and she's the wife of the other stuntman.
It's not stuntman Mike.
It's like another stuntman that is stuntman Mike, but it's. It's
Kurt
weird.
Russell. He's the
Kurt Russell's wife,
who's like but the head stuntman.
Yeah.
But Zoe Bell has appeared in like every single one of Tarantino's movies. At first, as a stunt person, she did a lot of stunts. She did all of Uma Thurman's stunts, I think, for Kill Bill, or she was the primary stunt person in Kill Bill.
I guess I didn't register. I didn't think it. I didn't think.
But she's become a kind of a star in her own right.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that bad.
All right. Well, let's talk about The Subtle Knife. How about that?
Yes, let's.
Sure. Let's.
We read chapters 1-4 of The Subtle Knife. This is the Brothers Geek Book Club. Welcome.
Welcome.
We're reading or listening to all the Golden Compass, the His Dark Materials
trilogy. Series.
So I listened to 1-4 on Audible. And like, I haven't read this. I had no idea what was coming. Chris, have you read these before?
Multiple times.
And then Andrew, have you read this at all?
I have not read Subtle Knife at all.
I saw the Golden Compass movie. So while I was reading the Golden Compass book, I kind of knew where things were headed. I had some idea, but obviously they changed some stuff and like the ending is different. But
Slash garbage.
Yes. And then I had no idea where this is going. And the first 4 chapters do not F around whatsoever. Nope. They get you right into it, and shit is crazy.
The centerpiece of the entire series is revealed in chapter 2.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that is the core of the whole thing. And
what's the centerpiece? What are you referring to?
The Lord Asriel's fight against the Authority, dude.
Oh, yeah.
Between worlds, so that he can kill
God.
Kill God.
Oh, okay.
That's
that
end game is the fact that he wants to eliminate the Almighty.
I thought you were talking about like the dust is basically dark matter.
Spoiler alert. That's the centerpiece of the entire trilogy.
Oh, so you're like spoiling the entire book series for us then.
No, I'm not.
Well, I mean, I think it gives Asriel more context because where he ends up at the end of book 1, you revile him. He kills a character you love.
Right.
And then to get this larger context from a person who would know, it puts everything in a totally different perspective.
Yep.
That he has an agenda. He's not just cruel. He's not just, you know, this self-centered egomaniac who's
It continues with the what's so compelling about the series, which is every character is compelling.
Yes.
Complex.
Yeah.
Interesting. Prophecies about Lyra are amazing. The chapter on the witches is freaking awesome. All of
she's like a goddamn ninja. And like I can't wait to see
Serena Pekkala.
Who's playing Serena Pekkala? Yeah, Serafina Pekkala. Who's playing that in here? I'm gonna look that up while we're
So the beginning of this book, we're introduced, we're in another world, we're in our world, ostensibly.
Yeah, and we get to meet
something very close to our world. Yes.
We meet Will Perry,
yes,
who is having his own moment of crisis.
Yes.
He is on the run for committing a crime.
Yeah.
His mother. Yeah. There's so much that goes on.
Who are these guys chasing her? His mother.
Dudes.
He kills the lethiometer.
I love that the fact that she asks the lethiometer and it tells her that he's a murderer.
It doesn't give any more context.
And it's accurate. I love it.
Yeah. He's a murderer. True. Yeah, that's what the lethiometer tells Lyra about Will. But she's a murderer.
But she even says to herself after it tells her he's a murderer that I feel comfortable with him. I think this is a person I should stay with.
Person who Lyra bonds with the most in the book is a bear, a self-aware, self-intelligent bear who is he kills people. He is a weapon of mass destruction that talks to her. She loves him. So
this is the thing that they didn't portray in the movie at all is that Lyra is not afraid of anything. And men stand around this bear and they are not friends with the bear. Deeply afraid of just being near the bear. And she stands next to it and doesn't give two shits. She can stand toe to toe and she'll lie to anybody. She's not afraid of any adult. She goes into a situation and immediately starts to figure out how to control it. And this is why she's like the centerpiece of this shit. I mean, she's the child who's gonna like save or change the world, is because and she's able to read the lethiometer. There's another lethiometer in chapter two. Right.
There's more context given.
I love that.
In the first couple chapters of this book.
Yep.
And you are kind of you get brought into it.
You're revealed. So much is revealed to you in these first chapters that it's amazing.
Yep.
So much stuff.
And if there was if there was any flaw or frustrating part of the first book to me, is that now that we're getting kind of all this more context, and who knows if it'll change because, we're getting bits and pieces of information based on what people think or think they understand about her. I mean, it's you consider the source with all this information. I mean, we're getting this from, members of the Magisterium. We're getting this from a witch who's under torture. We're getting this, consider where we're getting this information from. We're getting, half the facts, if that at all.
You're not sure who's the most reliable or.
Exactly. But clearly Lyra has a destiny and lots of people have been hiding it from her or keeping it from her. Lots of people know of her. Exactly. If that was knowing what I know now after reading just the first 100 pages of this book, there's so much setup in the first book that it's almost a little frustrating that there isn't more payoff.
It's true.
There's so much going on in the first book and it's so exciting and you're so interested. But now that we've gotten what we've gotten in the first 100 pages of the second book,
they really start. I mean, he hits you hard though in the first book with a lot of stuff. Like he's giving you a lot of the world, and immediately we're in another damn world, and shit's crazy.
We're in three worlds.
Three different worlds.
Travel between worlds in the specters.
I mean, he introduces notion where there's no adults, and the specters will get you. What the hell is that going on? An empty world has got to be freaky as hell for these kids, right?
This empty world, and all the adults have to hang out in the mountains to hide from the specters.
And the description, the writing is so good. The description of what happens to you if the specter catches up to an adult is like you were hollowed out.
Vividly.
Oh my God. The description of that is amazing.
I mean, it sucks that we have to basically wait till season two, probably, of the TV show.
They're going to build more narrative and context based on what's, because we just have we ride Lyra basically through the book. They're going to I think that Mrs. Coulter will have her own arc. We'll get more of Lord Asriel and his story and what he's doing while Lyra
What you're saying is it's good that we're reading all three books, but they're gonna give parts of and lead-ins to stuff that's happening in book two, in
stuff we don't actually witness in the book, will get
fleshed out.
Narrative.
I'm sure that they'll do that. 100%.
Well,
just I don't even think they mentioned the authority in the first book whatsoever. Like, no.
Said the word, but you don't get the context of the authority refers to an almighty God.
Totally. So,
as Christians / Catholics raised in that tradition would understand, a God to be.
Yeah, all the talk in the first book is about the magisterium, right? The church.
Mm-hmm, yep. Mm-hmm. This enormously baroque, really elaborate about. Power structure that has all these different councils and really kind of it's like just this huge obelisk that exists. Well, as this source of power in the world.
Authority.
For what they talk about in the first book, there's a lot of talk about the original sin stuff. And it kind of mirrors our world, but a little different.
The Bible story in Genesis being different in terms of how they introduced
But it's similar. It's similar enough that you don't it feels normal.
The image of the multiple universes existing together. Where they're breaking down the barriers between the two. I mean, Lyra even says it. There, she finds things jarringly different as she explores the new world that is like our world. But there are things that are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Like they speak the same language. They define things a little bit differently. Electricity versus ambaric power versus this versus that. Mm-hmm. Are there people that exist in both worlds, just different versions of themselves?
Yeah. Ooh.
Introducing that idea as well. She wonders whether
Will's
or not there's
father?
A
little, That's that? What I wanted. Who's Will's father?
Well, are you seeing the parallels between
Kira
Will's
says
background?
Goodnight, by the way.
What's that?
Kira says what?
Kira says goodnight.
Hi, good Kira. Goodnight, Kira. and think about too, the parallels that are being built between Will's backstory and Lyra's backstory, their fathers being absent, being explorers, how is that going to factor into what they're going to do?
It's really well done.
What happened to Will's mother that she's like gone insane? Has she gone
that
through
she is,
some,
she has some kind of emotional trauma or mental trauma she has, she's dealing
right,
with?
Right. She's seen some shit that her
He's
brain
the caretaker.
Couldn't.
That's another parallel with Lyra is that she acts and talks like an adult. She's mature for her age. So is Will.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely building the theme of, and it's clear that their stories are going to coincide or interact. I assume they're going to spend this book together. I know. Exactly. We'll see. But I mean, my appetite is totally is whetted for this book. I can't wait to read more.
Dude, it's this so good.
Is,
like,
I think this book is the favorite of my favorite of the three.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
They even mention the item that could protect her. That what's his name is going to go find. Is that the subtle knife? Is that I don't want to give it away. Don't tell us, Christopher. But that's my question. What's his name? Lee Scoresby says he's going to go try to find it for Lyra.
He's going to go find what's his name?
He's going to go the find dude, something.
The dude so, yeah. with the head. Yeah.
The dude with the head.
Yeah. The dude with the head. Yeah.
So much going on.
Yeah.
It's all great. It's so interesting.
It's so
read along with us because it's so good.
It's so you good. Should,
if you aren't reading these books. To get ready for that show coming out, you're missing out because these are fun.
These are fun, interesting reads. The writing is great. And I mean, don't be intimidated by the fact that, all the different storylines we're talking about. Yeah, there's a lot going on, but it's not intimidating to the sense that it's so dense you won't be able to follow everything.
The writing is not that complicated. It keeps you chugging along and it gives you everything.
Yeah, the writing is elegant and descriptive.
Yeah. Yes.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. It gives you everything.
Elegant is the way to put it.
And you don't feel bogged down. I felt bogged down even reading Dune. You feel bogged down with descriptors and it's heavy and like Lord of the Rings. It's not like that. This is just this is like a steam train and you're just along for the ride, just chugging along and it's giving you stuff and you're, but you don't stop going. Don't stop going. Don't stop. It's
wow. It's paced really, really well.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's a great adventure story so far. I can't wait to read it.
It's so good. So yeah, next time, five through eight
sounds good to me.
Let's keep that. Because what is your? I mean, you guys have the paper copies. Is it 16 chapters? 15 chapters?
I have the collected on Kindle.
I have the paperback, and we're through chapter 4. The title of chapter 4 is Trepanning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 5 is Airmail Paper.
Yeah, they're all the same chapters.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. So through the chapter 8, which is the Tower of Angels.
Finishing 8. We are finishing
8. Okay, yep. Great.
Awesome. Yep.
Read along for next time. Andrew.
Yeah.
Do you have some trivia for us?
I do, and there's a little bit of a story with trivia tonight.
Ooh, let's go. Let's go.
So myself, Ashton, Betsy, and Megan went to bar trivia last week at Copper Blues Live for Disney-themed bar trivia, and the place was packed. And if you guys have never been to bar trivia and it's theme night,
never done it.
So fun. Because
theme night sounds cool because it's like
I need to do it.
The regular kind of bar trivia cannot be as fun because you just get people in there playing and it's not as energetic. When you get in there for theme nights, I mean, people were dressed up. There were huge team, like there was teams of people wearing, you know, Disney t-shirts.
That's and awesome.
Their ears and stuff. So if you can find a theme night for trivia,
is this Disney cartoons?
Disney, all Disney movies.
All Disney movies.
And it was hard as shit.
I bet it was.
Sounds great fun.
It is so fun. And I'm giving you a trivia question that they asked us that night.
I love it. You need to get some more information about these. Who runs these trivia companies?
Triviatainment is the company.
Triviatainment. Okay.
And I follow them on Facebook.
Definitely credit them for the help
this
here.
This is the Disney question. This is one of, and they asked, there's like 50 questions throughout the night that they ask you.
How
and
did your team do, by the way?
We did not place. We were in the middle of the road.
Woo! And who did you take along? Who is your teammate?
I said Ashton, Betsy, and Megan.
Okay.
Yeah. And they are Disney fans, and they know Disney.
Right.
So here's an example. The question that they asked, this is one of the questions that they asked. In 101 Dalmatians, how many puppies did Perdita give birth to?
It's 13. Something 13? Like that. I think it's 13 or 15.
They did not give us options.
Shit, now I'm thinking it's 15. I think it's 13. 13 puppies.
Okay. Christopher, do you have a guess?
I'm going to go 14.
14. And I mean, we've all seen 101 Dalmatians at least once, right? If not multiple times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you think of how many times have you seen it in the last 10 years?
Oh, no, not once. Even.
Once?
Maybe,
once.
Yeah.
Yeah. The answer is 15.
Wow.
Right?
Like, I thought 15 secondary,
that is the level of obscurity that exists with these questions.
Damn, that's awesome.
I should have gone with my gut. 15.
You should have gone with your gut. 15 wow. puppies. But wow. that's the level of kind of obscurity that
that's a deep dive.
Like,
I love
and
that.
There'll be sections of the trivia night where it's going to be like, okay, the great next 10 questions, you have to complete these song lyrics. Give us who sang the song.
Oh my God.
Okay, so when you say all Disney movies, is this mainline animation or is it live action as well?
Mainline animation, Pixar, live action.
Oh, wow.
So they're doing like Swiss Family Robinson shit?
Return to Witch Mountain, like that?
It could be shit like that, yeah. But they focused on animated stuff. There was occasional questions of like live action movies, and there was a couple Pixar ones, but they went seriously obscure.
That's awesome.
Like they wanted to know what eye Scar had in for the Lion King, what eye his scar was on.
You got,
and
you got a 50-50 well, shot 50, there. 50,
yeah.
Yeah, I think you got, exactly. It was shit like there. One of the questions was in Monsters, Inc., the blue folders go to what department?
Oh,
seriously,
my God.
That was one of the questions, dude.
Wow.
dude, that's
because in one scene in that movie, there's a label on a folder thing that
somebody says out
somebody
loud
was the setting the blue folder on, it showed what department it's going to.
Yeah, somebody, there's a line of dialogue that literally says the blue folders go to blank, and it was
fantastic.
Accounting.
I love that.
Yeah,
I need to do more of that. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
bar trivia. We Ashton and I have been going to bar trivia, and we went to a Harry Potter themed night. We went to
Disney
night. I gotta find out if they do those up here because like
we go here geek trivia and stuff like that down here.
There are lots of bars that'll do general trivia. Nights.
Yeah, I got a general bar trivia, but I don't
go to the theme nights.
I love the idea of a theme night. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Ashton and I took second at a Game of Thrones trivia night. And you know, they do Harry Potter, they do Disney. I think there's a couple of companies that are doing like a Friends/Seinfeld trivia night, which that'll be some real obscure shit.
That's some real obscure shit.
Yeah. But anyway, so that was 15 puppies.
I love
15 it. 15 puppies.
Good
one. Thank you, Andrew. If you'd like to help Andrew with his trivia, you should email him at kingofthenorth52@gmail.com and email the podcast, brothersgeekpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, brothers_geek@twitter.com, brothersgeek.com, brothersgeekpodcast on Facebook. That's pretty much it.
Be curious. Don't forget to be curious, please. Live your life with curiosity.
Sounds great.